Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, our interesting customers pop in to rent something, and we go through the films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV? How's it?
Good morning.
How are you, my G-Force?
I'm all right, dude. How are you?
I'm okay.
All right.
I'm a little sick,
oh,
but I'm feeling better.
Okay, good.
Welcome to the video store.
Yeah.
Thank you for wandering in and browsing our shelves today. We have ourselves a very special episode.
Yes.
For those who are new and wandering in for the first time, we are typically just behind the counter. Mm. People like myself and Graham are doing shifts, and we are talking about the movies and the series that we're loving.
Yeah.
But every now and again, we want to share the conversations we have with the people who visit our video store.
Yes.
And that is what's happening today. Mm-hmm. My name is Russell. I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg, when I'm not working here at the video store. And G-Force here is an editor.
Hi.
And very much the producer of this show, the award-winning producer. Today, we're going to get a visit from my good friend, Bram.
Cool.
Bram is a Dutch man.
Mm.
And from my early days of living in Mabuneng, I had the incredible opportunity of getting to know him.
Cool.
He is a journalist of sorts, but one of the nicest ways I think one could phrase it is that he effectively is a war photographer.
Cool.
Which is one of the more exciting jobs someone could have in the world. And when he came back to South Africa for a visit, it was so lovely to catch up. And we banked this chat.
Cool.
And I think having him pop in today is key because I think it plays so nicely into the excitement and the themes around encounters.
Yes.
So, as I said, I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is a cinema, and once a year, one of our biggest highlights, unquestionably, is the Encounters Documentary Film Festival.
Yes.
So it is only documentaries from both South Africa and around the world, and a lot of what Bram does day in and day out, and everything about the chat that we're going to have, I think those themes and ideas all come up in the films that we screen every year at Encounters. So that's why I think it's a lovely tie-in to release this chat today.
Cool.
And to specifically highlight the fact that Encounters is coming. So in the week that this episode is coming out, this weekend, Encounters starts. It's spearheaded from Cape Town.
Mm.
The Bioscope has very proudly always screened Encounters literally since we started, which was 2010. So we've been doing it for 15 years now.
Ugh.
And usually, I don't want to jinx it, but usually the selection that Encounters manages to secure involves or includes the film that ends up winning the Oscar for Best Documentary.
Yeah.
They've often managed to do it. So this is really good stuff. The Bioscope selection is real special. We kick things off with this great documentary about Putin.
Okay.
There's some interesting AI documentaries as well.
Nice.
As well as these like beautiful small stories about communities aiming to do something.
Okay. You know,
whether it's through mental disabilities or all parts of the world. There's a documentary about Khartoum, which, you know, we don't think about Sudan often or enough. But, you know, all attention goes to, you know, Israel or Palestine or Ukraine. But a place like Sudan has got, like, far worse a war happening that the world kind of seems to forget sometimes. Mm. So it's a very important, very special week. I consider this the sort of fertilizer
All right.
in terms of the programming for The Bioscope, as opposed to the, you know, the sweet icing.
Yes.
This is what kind of really makes the Bioscope special, and it's a huge honor to always host it. So over at thebioscope.co.za, you'll see the Encounters poster for the coming attractions. Otherwise, one could go to encounters.co.za and get your tickets. They're only 90 Rand, and we always love these weeks. We're screening it from the 20th to the 29th.
Okay.
And over the course of this time, we tend to see the same people that come for many screenings. Mm. So we sort of build this little family over the course of a week, and that's always a treat. And
that's
then, of course, we often get some new folks that can come to the Bioscope more often thereafter. So it's a lovely hunting ground for customers. but I think let's not waste any more time. This is a great opportunity to learn about a very unique job.
Yeah.
And what it takes.
Cool.
I think that's the real key, is like what kind of toll it has on you, and what kind of approach you need, and really a good look behind the curtain, which I love these chats to be.
Yes.
How the media jobs happen in real life.
Yeah.
All right, let's do it. This is Bram Janssens popping in to rent something. Good to see you.
Yeah, likewise. We go, but like I was thinking about it the other day, we go way back, but we never see each other, but we do go quite some time back.
You are one of those people in my life that I hope to see as much of as possible, but if it's not all the time, it'll be every few years, and it'll be here or in Amsterdam. So it was cool when I posted last year that I was in Amsterdam. It was so cool to see a response from you on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit, yeah, you're here.
Yeah. But I have that all the time because I got friends all over the world. You know, I've been traveling, I've been living in so many different places. Like all over, you know.
Yeah. No, well, that's the thing. I've always known you were obviously Dutch. You're one of the Dutch guys, which I'll talk about. There was a lovely crew of you guys that just happened to be in Mabuneng.
Yeah.
For many years, and for those who know, with the Bioscope, our big history was being in Mabuneng. And then, when I was in Amsterdam, I was like, yeah, of course, you could be in Amsterdam, but you could be anywhere in the world. And I think that's perhaps a good place to start. If we were at a dinner party, how do you introduce yourself? If someone says, hey, so what do you do, Bram?
Well, very simple. I mean, I'm a journalist at first. So.
Okay, so you say journalist before you say photographer.
Yeah, sometimes I would say photographer, I guess. But the thing is, photographer, then you always have to explain stuff. So what kind of photography do you do? So if you say journalist and, you know...
Because you can't really respond at a dinner party and go, war? War photography.
That's the second question that's being asked. So what kind of photography? I'm like, oh, you know, mostly conflict zones, go to war zones, that kind of stuff. and then you got two responses.
What do you get?
So sort of silence. They don't know what to do with that. They're like, okay, do I have to start talking about wars now or conflicts? Can I give my opinion on Palestine right now?
Yeah.
And or immediately people start to become very, they're very serious. So they want to immediately dive deep into, which is also kind of awful. Because for me, every time like people think that they have to talk about very serious stuff with me, I don't want to talk about that. Like,
I would imagine.
It's like, that's my whole life. That's what all I do, like all every day. Like, I don't want it. I don't want to talk about that at a dinner party.
Well, so we're not quite a dinner party, but I'd love to get into a bit of it. What is something that's like you're in the middle of right now? Like, where are you? Have you been away recently? Are you planning another trip?
Yeah.
Where are you now?
I'm about to go to Afghanistan end of the month. And that was quite of a journey because I've been to Afghanistan quite a bit.
How many times?
This would be my fourth time.
Okay.
Yeah. And I go for a longer period. So I'd say like 6 weeks or 4 to 6 weeks, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's all of that has been since the takeover of the Taliban. So in the past few years. What was it, 21, I think, on the top of my head? 22.
Yeah, I forget. We all saw that footage of those last American planes leaving, and then they were like, and it's Taliban rule now.
Awful. It was awful. And so that's what I'm planning right now. And it took a long time because I was blacklisted for a while. So it took me about like 8 months to get a new visa.
Okay. And the Taliban blacklisted you.
Yeah.
Okay.
You never know why. Like, yeah. you don't get a reason why. It's just you're blacklisted. We're not going to give you another visa.
Yeah.
So it took a lot of lobbying, and eventually I got a new visa.
Where would you go to get an Afghanistan visa?
That's very interesting, because all the embassies closed globally. So there's only, I think, two or three embassies operating. Maybe might be a little bit more. And one of them is The Hague, and I'm in Amsterdam, so it's they're in London.
Oh, cool.
So, and they still operate. They don't get money from the Taliban. They still operate because families want to visit relatives in Afghanistan, so they need visas for that. So their reasoning is, like, we just stay open. We sell visas, so you pay quite a lot of money for a visa.
Okay.
Because that's how they operate.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, people want to visit relatives, so why should we... You know, and
then, stop them, yeah. But the Taliban aren't allowing other people to come in. They aren't allowing those kind of...
They do. There's quite a bit of tourism going.
Yeah.
At the moment. So if you're, you know, and you're an adventurous tourist, you can go to Afghanistan. Relatively safe at the moment, so...
Is it?
Yeah.
It's okay, because let's go to your trip now. What would you hope to achieve, and what are you going to be looking to do?
We obviously focus on the bigger topic, so that would... You know, women in Afghanistan at the moment, like, they're not allowed to, they're banned from everything, they're not allowed to work, they're not allowed to do anything really. So we're trying to find, I don't want to give a bit too much, but we're trying to find stories around that,
okay.
Which is very challenging, because you don't want to put women in jeopardy, you don't want to, you know, if you talk to them or you photograph them, it's obviously, that could be...
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be a problem.
Who is we, when you say we?
So now we're going with a team of three. There's one writer. For this trip, I do video. And then there's another photographer who also speaks the language. He's Iranian. He speaks the language. And he's been there for a long time. So that's
saves us. Who's commissioning this?
The Associated Press, AP. So I'm still employed by the AP, which is an American news agency. And okay. But I work for the investigations department and the feature department. So we do... I don't really do... hard news. I do like features,
the stories, the longer
yeah,
stories.
Yeah, longer stories, long term kind of.
And how does that work? You would create this sort of package of content for them, and then they distribute it to their networks, right?
Yeah, because they are one of the largest news agencies in the world, so they have customers. So let's say you got CNN or you got ABC News, and they all have a subscription. And then
okay.
All of that material, the photos, text, the videos, all goes to them, and they can just take whatever they want.
Okay, so CNN would build a pipeline that'll come from many places, one of which will be AP.
Yeah, correct.
And it'll just come down the pipe, and then they'll go, cool, well, we can do this here, we can put this there, we can repeat it, we can repackage it, we can do whatever
yeah,
we want.
Yeah, and the idea is that you can't be everywhere as a network or as an organization or as a newspaper, right? You can't be, let's say you were a small Dutch newspaper or a French newspaper.
Yeah.
You can't have people all over the world.
Yeah, you can't just send a team to Afghanistan.
You know, like
yeah.
Because and then they when something big happens, like take over the Taliban,
yeah.
They just take from the agencies, you know, the photos, and they publish them to their newspaper.
Okay, so you could have a photograph, and I'm sure this has happened many times, that you've just seen in so many different places.
Yeah.
And do you have one paycheck, or do you get a bit of a royalty?
No. No.
That
wish.
Would be too difficult. It'd be too difficult to coordinate.
Yeah, and that's not how news agencies operate. I mean, I know that some do, like, for example, New York Times operates like that, where they keep, if they republish the photo or whatever, they have to pay you every time.
Yeah.
No, it's not with us. With the agencies, it's not like that, because it's...
Because that also might stop people from taking it
yeah,
and doing it if they have to pay royalties every time.
It's one of these things, right? I mean, it's give or take. Like, you can't, you want to publish your material.
Yeah.
Okay,
because I remember this amazing insight when there was that terrible... shooting in Las Vegas. There was that one really horrible one that happened at a concert.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget reading the anxiety of the photographers that were there, where they were like, this is devastating. This is like I'm in this kind of crazy PTSD, whatever, like this moment, but I have to upload these photos to certain agencies so that this news can be spread around the world.
Yeah.
And they would ultimately get money, because from some of those places, you can upload your photos. People will pay to use them. And you're actually in this rare little moment where, as terrible as the moment is, it's an opportunity for you to make like quite a lot of money. Have you found yourself in that kind of place, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I get a salary, so for me, that's not really the case. But but I know that I work for a company. It's a business model. It's a business. News is a business.
Yeah.
So if there's big news happening, I know that we need to be the first, and we need to have the best pictures, and we need to have the best video, because it pays for our salaries. That's just how it works. I mean, it's sometimes. Yeah.
It's interesting to hear these moments and hear like that story in particular. And I'd love to get into some of the stories and the moments that have happened in your life that stick out.
Yeah.
My dad is one of those retired gentlemen that play like four games of golf a week.
Yeah.
And he got partnered with someone because, sometimes you get partnered up if you are a single person or two people and you make a four ball. And so you often play with very interesting strangers. And he was playing golf once with a guy who was a probably more written journalist who, this was many years ago, was stationed in South Africa. He was like French, basically waiting for Nelson Mandela to die.
Yeah, that's why I came to South Africa.
Okay.
So I was a freelancer. I was on a desk in the Netherlands. I still lived in the Netherlands. I just finished university.
Yeah.
And I was freelancing and I was just writing articles or whatever. I was taking pictures for a news website. And I remember this very clearly, right? It was during the Arab Spring. And if you remember this, right?
Yeah,
and Mubarak fell, the president of Egypt.
Yeah.
And there was a moment, it was a big announcement on TV. And for weeks, there was a build-up, for weeks, if not months, with all the riot, like the protests.
Yeah,
and it was incredible scenes, these camels going through Tahrir Square. And it was an incredible story. Mm. And then he fell, and I was working that day at a shift. And they were celebrating in front of the TV, like my colleagues. And they were like, "We were there, we were there." And I was looking at them, I was like, "No, you weren't there, you were just watching TV." And next day or a few days later, I quit and I was like, no, I'm out of here. So I went to South Africa. I already did an internship in South Africa. So I had a network, I had some friends.
Yeah.
Took a plane, didn't have a plan, but I knew one thing was that, and that's where I get to the story, was that, at some point, Nelson Mandela is going to die.
Is going to pass away.
Yeah, it's going to pass away.
And
that's a big story.
And if those folks remember, he was sick for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was imminent, but it was for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And this poor dude was stranded from his family, like playing golf, like literally just waiting for this dude to die.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I was actually, and then that's how I got to the AP. That's how I started working for them. They started paying me a monthly retainer. So they would just pay me, didn't have to do anything for it.
Yeah.
But what I had to do the moment he passed away, I had to work exclusively for them.
Okay.
So I was just, was it a year, 2 years? I was just getting paid without doing anything.
That's
just
amazing.
Waiting. Yeah, just waiting.
But I mean, I guess building a network and building connections.
Yeah.
But sorry, just to go back to that moment with the previous job, what was the moment where they were saying, "We were there," but you were like, "You're not"?
Yeah, when Mubarak fell, right? There was a big announcement on TV.
Yeah.
And it was, everybody was waiting for that. And then there was an editor there. And he was shouting like, "We were there. We witnessed it."
You witnessed it from Amsterdam.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
That's how you saw it.
Yeah. I was like, you weren't there. You were just watching TV. So I wanted to be.
You wanted to be there.
I was like, I need to travel. I need to get out of here. Yeah. I'm not going to sit at the desk the rest of my career. And just with all the respect, but I was like, no, I want to be there myself.
Yeah. Okay. So then you made South Africa your home.
Yeah.
For the longest time.
Yeah. Very quickly.
And then did you travel to other parts of Africa from there? Where did you go?
A little bit. Not so much. A little bit. I mean, mostly Southern Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana. We did stories all around. It was an amazing time. And it was also the time when we lived in Mabinang. Amelie moved to Mabinang. It was in the early stages. And you guys just started.
Yeah, that was the best time.
It was an incredible time. It was an incredible time because we got to know so many different people from different walks of life. And it was just, I don't know, there was some vibe around it. It was just...
It was a very special moment.
Very liberating.
Because for us, for me personally, it felt quite liberating because I'd grown up in the suburbs. Mm. I've been lucky enough to travel around the world as a privileged young kid. And I remember at one point going, but where's our city? Mm. Literally like going, where's Joburg City? Do we have a city? Mm. Do we have big buildings? Literally, yeah, like yeah, that amazing, young. Yeah, yeah. And then getting a chance once to drive through the back of downtown and going, oh my God, we've got fucking big city. We've got big buildings.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
And then me being, from then on, quite fascinated about what that was, what downtown was.
Yeah.
Why I'd never actually had to go there.
Yeah.
You know, the high streets had left and there's really only these big banking complexes. And then when I was a proper adult, at university, I wanted to explore it. I wanted to try and be a part of this. It was definitely a feeling of trying to get more access into the city. And I was the first to go to some of those nightclubs and live music venues. And so then when Mabuneng came, that was why the Bioscope needed to be there, because it was this exciting new sort of way to enter into the city.
Yeah. And it was a great place because it was, I remember we were all sitting outside in the street and we would have our drinks there, our sundowners there, and people would just pass by and they would join us. And it was, at that time, it was small. Mabuneng was small, right? It was one building. It was like that first.
But there was no big gate, even in Melrose Arch, which is in a very safe neighborhood. You know, there's this big boomed gate. So it's like this kind of play fake city. Mabuneng, anything could come around the corner. Yeah. Right? Literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
One day, I'll never forget this. You'll love this story. I don't know whether you were still in Mabuneng. I got a call from Owen, our manager. And he's like, there's a naked guy. And I'm like, what? Literally a dude who's like lost his mind. Like literally, you can imagine like needs psychotic meds, you know?
Yeah.
Was literally walking through the city. Okay. Came around the corner, walked down Fox Street, butt fucking naked. Butt naked. Till eventually our security guards put him in. Then remember there was that little guardhouse, there was that ball.
Yeah.
That like geodesic dome.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Send pictures. Like, what are you talking about? And then I got these blurry photos of this naked dude sitting in the guardhouse. Anything could happen.
Yeah.
There was one year where there was quite a bad outbreak of xenophobic riots.
Yeah.
Which is always quite scary for Mabuneng because we were very close to the men's hostels.
I remember this too.
And we were, ironically, in this one particular outbreak of violence, completely safe because someone literally stood on the one corner of Mabuneng and just waved to people like, go this way. Everybody's going this way. And so this whole crowd just moved past Mabuneng.
Wow.
And they just managed to just...
Wow.
To have Mabuneng completely excluded from this huge riot.
Yeah, yeah, man. It was, but it was one of these places where I think you would just meet so many different people from, well, like I said,
exactly. I got a chance to meet you guys.
Yeah,
Dutch guys.
It was like there's so many artists that came from there now and like big names and great. It was amazing. Like for your network, it was
because
amazing.
There was you as Brahm, and then there was Brum.
There's not a Brum, yeah.
But did you pronounce your names differently?
No, exactly the same.
Oh,
yeah.
So are you more Brum than Brahm?
No, it's both Brum. Brum. Yeah, Brum. If you say in Dutch, it would say Brum. Yeah.
Brum.
Brum.
And then who was the third guy?
Niels.
He
was like a tall, tall, old journalist.
You guys were all tall Dutch guys.
Yeah.
And I very, probably... hopefully you didn't take offense, but I always announced you guys whenever you arrived. I was always like, it's the Dutch guys. No, you guys were lovely. I actually made friends when I went on one of my trips to the Netherlands. I went to Pink Pop.
Oh, yeah.
I was stationed in Helsinki on a documentary exchange program at the end of varsity. And I was trying to see the Foo Fighters, which was my like all-time favorite. Never thought they'd ever come to the tip of Africa. And in this kind of summer festival season, the trip that made the easiest sense, timing, economics-wise, was going to Pink Pop. And went on by myself. And it was one of these amazing moments where you're surrounded by 100,000 people, yet you feel very lonely. Because a music festival is usually something you do with friends.
Yeah.
And I was okay. You know, I'm okay with my own company. Had a beer, sort of had a pizza, sat by myself. And while I was watching one band, I heard the people talking English behind me. And the one person said, they were talking about the Dutch people or something. And they said, you know that the Dutch people are the tallest people in the world?
Yeah.
And I'd never known that.
Yeah.
And so I turned around and I said, oh,
really?
That's interesting. And we became friends for the rest of the day. Nice. So your tallness.
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny that made you this incredible experience.
It's also nice that you mentioned Pinkpop because I'm actually from that region, from the Netherlands. Okay. So I grew up at that festival. Like we would go there. So, you know, we were very young. We would go there and it was amazing.
It's the big festival not of anymore, the Netherlands.
But it used to be. Not anymore. I mean, it's they're really in decline the past 10 years. But no, before that, yeah, absolutely. All the big names were there, man.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was great. And it was one of these areas where nobody really used to come. But then there was Pinkpop and the whole Netherlands came to that festival.
Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm glad I got close to your homeland.
Yeah. Maybe I was there that year as well. Yeah, I haven't seen the Foo Fighters there. But
it was Foo Fighters on the one day, Incubus on the other day, and Rage Against the Machine on the third.
I think I was.
And speaking of conflict and war zones, the Rage Against the Machine dudes sort of reenacted this, like,
I remember this.
Guantanamo Bay scene on stage as a sort of a political statement.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's get into some of the... actually, before that, have you got anything that you're returning to our video store?
I am. I just watched this documentary that you also playing in the Bioscope.
At the Bioscope,
Ernest Cole.
Lovely.
Amazing. I was really blown away. And it's funny because I mean, I knew Ernest Cole a little bit. I knew his work a little bit, but I wasn't really familiar with it. Right?
Yeah.
A few months ago, there was an exhibition in Amsterdam, at Foam Museum. Foam is it's a photo gallery / museum in the middle of Amsterdam. And it was a Palestinian photographer, a friend of mine, amazing photographer. And so I went there, and it was so busy. So I was like, oh, I can't. I'll go back when it's less busy. So I went to the bookshop, which you do, exit through the gift shop, right? And I was going through some books, and then Ernest Cole's book was there,
House of Bondage. Yeah.
And I didn't know the book, so I bought it there, right? Okay. And, I was like, oh, this is amazing. I just after going through a few pages, I was like, this is incredible stuff. Mm. And he apparently had an exhibition a few months before that, which I missed. It's terrible.
Okay.
And then I came here to Joburg a few weeks ago, and I saw the poster. And I was like, ah, amazing. Like, I didn't know there was a documentary. So I watched a documentary and it was incredible. I highly recommend it.
We saw it coming a while away, and it was the opening night of the Joburg Film Festival. And after the festival, the Bioscope's been screening it. And it's a lovely slow burner for us. We're just keeping it on. Folks are coming. So we're just going to keep screening it.
What a story.
And what it is effectively it's all about this guy called Ernest Cole, who was a important South African photographer during apartheid, who quite quickly needed to leave and moved across to New York, had this book published, which we're talking about, called House of Bondage, which I then managed to get a copy of at Exclusive Books here, and I think sometimes it's available on Takealot. But it's an art book. In this incredible photography that was quite important in showing the world what apartheid looked like
from the black perspective.
Which is the most important thing, because he could probably hide in corners and not be treated differently because he was a black person in these environments and could get this kind of access or this reaction from black people. And this book got published in the rest of the world. It got banned in South Africa. Mm. So that's why South Africa, for the most part, doesn't really know Ernest Cole. And then this film is this incredible portrait of what his life was like afterwards. Yeah. Raoul Peck, who is a very credible documentary filmmaker.
Is he South African, by the way?
No, he's Haitian.
Ah, okay.
And he actually has served in the government of Haiti.
Oh.
In their sort of ministry of culture.
Okay.
Very politicized individual, and has said, he was at the Joburg Film Festival, he said, I want to make political documentaries. Mm. I want to make political films. That's my agenda. Because after this book got published, Ernest Cole struggled to, he just struggled personally. He couldn't get back into South Africa. Yeah. He couldn't figure out his own personal identity. Spent some time in Sweden, spent most of his days in New York, and ultimately died close to homeless.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was one of the most, that was what impressed me most was like, he as a photographer in South Africa, he was documenting what was happening, you know, in his own neighborhood, in his own, you know, in his own country. Mm. And that was that, you know, that was for him, that was his life. That was his, and when he went to New York, he suddenly didn't have that anymore. Like he didn't know, you know, he was documenting New York. He was taking pictures, but he wasn't, it wasn't his. So, and
he was this kind of outsider.
He was an outsider and it's a completely different way of working and completely different way of, you know, and he got hired, I think, by the New York Times, to document, the racism that's in the South, like in, and they weren't happy with his photos. And he was like, what do they expect? Like, this is not my... They wanted the same photos as I was taking in South Africa.
Mm.
I was like, but it's not... That's not, you know...
It's very interesting.
Yeah, that was super interesting.
Yeah. And then what was fascinating is that once he passed away, someone around him had access to all these photographs, all these negatives. And they obviously saw a value in it, but they didn't quite know what to do. And so they stored it in this bank vault.
Mm.
For decades, and nobody knew it existed until they obviously, maybe whoever had put them in, it remains a bit of a mystery, but whoever put them in maybe just realized, okay, let's get rid of this now, or let's free these up. But they never claimed who they were, but his family, his estate, got this message, come to Sweden and unlock this bank vault and take the contents and get back to South Africa.
Yeah.
They paid, it's so interesting, they paid for the brother or the son or something to literally arrive, get to the bank vault, get home.
Yeah.
And so this film really is all those photographs, and it's the portrait of this photographer through these now unearthed photographs. And something you'd appreciate is that they interviewed a lot of people and they went through all his journals, and the filmmaker tried to embody him. And had this actor sort of read this writing as if he is Ernest Cole.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said they interviewed lots of people and they avoided anecdotes. They avoided, like, you know, maybe this could have happened or didn't happen.
Yeah.
And they only went with what was in the journals or what was clear fact.
And in the photos.
And in the photos to try and accurately give a voice to this person who's long since passed away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like the guy like lives on. Yeah. It's like he's this ghost that's talking through these photos. And you basically for an hour and a half just watch photos.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's very little video or moving images. It's like you're watching these photos. It's quite hypnotic.
And you know he's a beautiful documentary. You know he's not alive anymore, but you still think that he's the one who's telling the story. And it's really well done. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking. And I immediately sent it to my editors too. So you gotta watch this.
Yeah. So it's called Ernest Cole, Lost and Found.
Yeah.
Screenings are still taking place at the Bioscope. I don't know where its future will go. Hopefully it'll be available on some kind of streaming platform at some point, but it's out there and it's a document that can live on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I'd imagine that's probably one of the more rewarding parts of your job is knowing that you're creating these documents.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, look, that was a different time, right? I mean, that was a time when I think photography was much more valued as it is today.
You had to develop it, you had to print it.
It was much more exclusive, you know. Not the whole world was walking around with a camera and on the phone.
Yeah, totally.
So, it has devalued a little bit, but there's still definitely an importance. I mean, you still get photographs today that are, that go into the history books. I mean, the last photos, I think one of the last photos was when Trump got shot, for example, that photograph of when he stood up and raised his fist and shouted, fight, fight. That's an iconic photograph, you know. Yeah. So it still happens.
And this is what I've always said to people, because I dabbled a bit in photography myself and I've also always loved it across my life. And I've just said that the power of photography is that you have to be there.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, like music, you can sit in your bedroom, you can sit in your underpants and make spacey guitar loops, and you can do whatever you want. Writing, you can also go into faraway lands. Photography, you got to fucking be there.
Yeah, and there's no excuses.
You got to be standing in the best position to get that photo of Trump. Yeah. You can't be at the back with the zoom lens.
No.
And you got to be there. And I'll never forget one of my early sort of realizations of this was the South African photographer Liam Lynch.
Mm.
Who took a lot of iconic photos of the band Focof Politica, which kind of set them on a particular course as a band. It was as a result of these photos. And when you watch them perform and you watch him take photos of them, when Francois van Cooke, who's actually been a guest on the video store, he's a lovely dude, when he jumps and crowd surfs and sings, Liam jumps next to him.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. He crowd surfs and photographs him.
Nice.
And I remember just thinking, that's how you get the
photo.
That's it.
You know,
you've got to jump into the crowd too. Yeah.
And there's no excuses. Like my editor always says, like, I can't publish excuses. You know, well, what are you saying? Why weren't you there? What happened? I don't care what happened. You didn't get the photograph. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What have been some of these like moments for you? Less about the actual photographs, but where have there been some of these moments where you're like, oh my God, I'm fucking here.
Oof, man, so many moments. I think there are a few iconic moments where, especially I lived in Iraq, right? I went from South Africa, I went to live in Iraq, in northern Iraq. And it was the war against ISIS that started then. And I was there the day it happened. So I was supposed to go to Iraq to do some, you know, some light stories, some features.
Yeah.
I landed and literally 10 days later, ISIS took over Mosul, the city in Iraq. And it became like the number one story on the planet, right? Everybody was talking about ISIS. Who are these guys? What is this? And I was literally there as one of the very few.
Yeah.
Because I had no reason to be there. Like I was, you know, it wasn't like, nobody saw this coming. Yeah. I just happened to be there, you know?
Yeah.
And there were like thousands and thousands of people fleeing from the area from these sort of then monsters, right? These ISIS guys. Who are these guys? Like these terrorists that are beheading people. And those were iconic moments, you know, when when all these people were fleeing. You know, and then I think when they started to do the pushback, when they started to fight back, which was a few years later, when they actually, it became a, how do I say this, like a street battle, right?
Yeah.
In the city of Mosul, it was an incredible. There were incredible scenes. It was a war that was literally playing out from street to street, you know.
Yeah.
With snipers and what have you not. And
was this the Americans?
No, so the Americans weren't, so to speak, actively involved. But they were bombing from the sky.
Yeah.
And then Iraqi special forces, they would go in.
Okay.
So they would do the street battles. But we always saw some Americans, you know, behind the front lines, like coordinating. And that's one photo I took at that time was a big sort of all these like Humvees and these vehicles driving off into the desert. And it was sunrise and back.
Yeah.
And it was like this sort of like a scene from the Middle Ages almost, right? Where you have these horses go into battle.
Interesting.
And this was that photo got a lot of attention. So that was and then you're like, you take that photo and you're like, wow, that's quite a moment.
Yeah, you can see the day it was announced.
Yeah, it was the day when it was announced, and then it sort of, and that was the picture that was used by a lot of media all over the world where they were like, the battle against ISIS has started.
Hectic.
Yeah. So you have these moments for sure.
Yeah. You were in the West Bank recently?
Yeah. Last year.
Fairly recently.
Last year. It was, I can't even remember. I'm so terrible at dates. August, September, August.
Yeah. I think you'd, yeah, I'd seen you in July.
Okay. And I was back then.
So it was just, you'd just come back.
Okay. So it was just when before
we had
that,
our
yeah.
when we had our coffee yeah. in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
Intense, man.
What is that sort of Gaza, West Bank, Israel, Palestine? What is your relationship with all of that?
I don't really have a relationship with it. As in, like, there was my first time I actually went there.
Okay.
For some reason, I never made it there.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So I mean, that's the question: is that you actually hadn't covered that before?
No. Which in a way is a good thing, right? Because you completely, in a sense, open-minded, and you go there without any prejudice or whatever. Yeah. You know, like.
So you didn't go into Gaza itself. You were in
the
West Bank.
No, you can't. They don't allow a Western journalist to go into Gaza.
Interesting.
So nobody has been. So we try, but nobody has been. So it's only...
That's because of Hamas have controlled that. Or who's controlling
that?
No,
that's the Israelis are controlling that.
Oh.
So they don't allow. They obviously don't want to, you know, don't want to show what's going on there.
The fact that they have that control is interesting.
Yeah, because they control all the borders.
Yeah.
So they decide who goes in and who goes out.
I'm a bit ignorant to all of this.
Yeah, no, okay. There's nothing you can do without the Israelis knowing. Nothing.
Interesting.
Nothing. So you have, obviously, you have local journalists, Gazans. Like they are absolute heroes in this story because they have been publishing these photos and videos for the last years.
Yeah.
Since October 7th. Hundreds have been killed. You know, they just die. Like it's their like we were just talking about Ernest Cole.
Yeah.
You know, who's telling his own story basically during apartheid South Africa. They are telling their own story and they die doing it.
Shit.
It's really intense. It's really crazy. And it's, what can I say? I mean, you know, this story is the same story. This story that I did, I could have done that 30 years ago.
What was the story that you did?
So we did a story about the effect on young people. The West Bank is now, there are a lot of settlers, Israeli settlers who take over certain areas, certain cities, certain towns. You always have the Israeli forces go in and they do these raids where they arrest or kill supposedly terrorists who
this is inside Palestine.
This is inside, so it's the West Bank, yes. Yeah, inside Palestine.
The West Bank is Palestinian. Yeah.
And they and then what I did, I just they call them terrorists. You can call them, you know, the Palestinians call them freedom fighters.
Yeah.
Whatever label you want to put on it, right?
Okay.
So I joined, you know, I joined them, these the Palestinians, and also tried to show what that means for young people and for kids. You know, some kids, they get caught up in the crossfire and die. But other kids, they have a cousin or brother who joins the militias, and they see them as examples. It has an effect on everyone.
Yeah, you shared a story when we were having breakfast about someone, which was like, you sort of wonder how something like Hamas happens, how these folks get more and more aggressive and more and more radicalized, and I think you shared a story of like. Someone whose brother died, or
it was like there was a twin. There were twins, and one brother. So what happens? These raids happen, right? Yeah. They go into the city. The Israelis go into the city undercover, and then they have people on every side of the corner, like the militants, right? The Palestinians have, and then this alarm goes off. So that means throughout the city. So it's a bustling city, right? This is a bustling city. People are, you know, smoking the water pipe. People are having, this.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, within 10 minutes, it's like, boom, everything is empty. Like, the streets are empty. Everybody goes home. They know, like, you know.
Shit.
We have to hide. And what happened was this
Because
kid,
one of these raids is happening, yeah.
You know, so that means a lot of crossfire, back and forth shooting. One kid... 15-year-old went home on his bicycle from school. So the school actually sent him home. They were like, quick, go home, while this alarm was going off.
Yeah.
Goes home, Israeli sniper shoots him for whatever reason. You know, it's just a kid with a backpack.
Fuck's
and sake. He gets shot off his bicycle.
Yeah.
And...
Can't really be confused as something else, eh?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Carry on. Yeah.
I saw the pictures. There were pictures of the kid lying on the ground that we managed to see, and it's a kid coming from school.
Yeah.
And he had a twin brother, and the twin brother was just sitting there at home now. They shared a bedroom. It was, everything was the same, like the same bed sheets and everything.
Yeah,
was.
Yeah.
They shared a whole life together.
Yeah.
And suddenly I took one photo of this brother sitting on his bed next to the empty bed.
Yeah.
And you know, and his father was saying, you know, this is the problem. What am I going to tell him? I tried to keep them away from everything, from, you know, from radicalizing or from, but what am I going to tell him now? What am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know? So, and that's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah. He's going
to, so those kind of stories.
Grab, yeah.
Yeah. So these kind of stories, that's what I'm trying
yeah.
to, trying to tell.
Okay.
So I, look, I don't go in there, you know, of course I have an opinion. Everybody has an opinion.
Sure.
So, but my opinion does not matter, right? I'm not there to publish my opinion. I'm not there to,
yeah.
I am there to just tell the story as it is, as I see it, and
yeah.
what is happening on the ground. That's my job.
Yeah,
and that's what I can contribute.
And that was what was so powerful about Ernest Cole. As I said, it wasn't Raoul Peck's opinion.
No.
If in his notes he said he went there and he did this and he said this, then that's what this character says
yeah.
as Ernest Cole.
Yeah.
And yeah, and you just saying, here's this little boy, his
yeah.
twin brother
yeah.
got shot.
That's it.
Riding home on his bicycle.
Yeah. And now his dad is like, you know, he's desperate because he doesn't know what to do and doesn't know what to tell this kid anymore.
Yeah.
You know, for all these years, for 15 years, he was telling them to stay away from all of that.
And now it's come to their house.
Yeah, now it's come to their house.
How do you sleep at night?
Yeah, I'm good. I sleep well. I mean, so it's one of these things where it's kind of almost a cliche to say, but I have my camera, which is my filter, you know, I'm there to do a job.
Yeah.
I'm there to, and that's also my way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
The thing that you have to deal with, what I always tell young people who want to go into the same industry and same business, is that the biggest issue, and I've seen this so many times also with all the journalists, and is the you have to cope with the adrenaline levels, right? So you go into war zones, you go into conflict zones, and you go, there's a certain adrenaline. It's also, you hear that a lot from war veterans, right?
Yeah.
Soldiers. And that's constantly, that adrenaline is being fed, right?
Mm.
You're constantly on this high almost.
Yeah.
Because you constantly have to be aware, there's this danger, et cetera, et cetera. If you don't manage that the moment you get back home, you got a problem.
Okay.
Or you're going to have a problem.
Yeah,
not straight away, but maybe after a year, maybe after 2 years, maybe after 5 years, maybe after 10 years. But it will come for you. It will come for you. If you don't,
What does that come for you? What is that?
It could be nightmares. Could be PTSD, typical PTSD nightmares. Could be starting to drink, starting to, you know, you want to get this high.
You crave that feeling again. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you gotta manage it.
Yeah.
And if you don't manage it, you will have a problem. And you think you don't need it because you think you got, and you think you can. You're young, and nothing will happen to you.
Yeah.
And I thought that. I've been there. Where, you know, it was I have a beautiful wife. We're very happily married. Got two beautiful kids.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I didn't take care of her at that time. I was just, you know, when I was home, I went partying. I went, you know, I'm ashamed at that time, right?
Okay.
I'm embarrassed talking about it almost. But that was the whole case. And now I know, you know, I'm older. I've been doing it for so long. I manage it.
But you've got something. I mean, you had her there at the time, but I mean, perhaps it's like, you know, you've got something to live for. You've got more fulfillment at home. You've got other things. It's like
also,
what you're describing is very similar to musicians, where you have thousands of screaming fans and you get this beautiful rush for 2 hours. And you often hear of the likes of Robbie Williams and folks admitting to, like, fuck, it's depressing when you go back to the hotel room and it's just you.
And it's
you
quiet.
Just had 100,000 people screaming your name and now it's just you.
Yeah.
And it's just quiet.
Yeah.
And you got to be okay with that.
Yeah.
And that only works if you've got some love and some contentment
and
some fulfillment waiting for you.
Yeah, and it could be, you know, but it could also be, you know, you would go and you do yoga, or you go, you know, and exercise a lot. But you got to get it out of your system, you know. You got to get it out of your system.
Okay. No, that's very interesting.
So same with musicians. I can totally relate.
Yeah. Totally. No, you can't burn it. You can't burn it on both ends.
No. Okay. You never, not for too long. You might be able to do it for a little bit, but.
Your wife is South African.
She's from Botswana.
She's actually from Botswana.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. She lived. Okay, but moved here after apartheid.
But Southern African. So you kind of you've got a link to us.
Yeah,
now.
Man. I got the family here. I mean, it's funny because my oldest son is 7. He was born here. We moved when he was 4, just turning 4. Moved to Amsterdam. So we lived in Johannesburg. We moved to Amsterdam. Mm. And he loves it here, man. It's like I was just talking to my wife here last night, and seeing him here is like he's at home. You know, he's really at home. Like it just comes so natural to him, and he loves it. And it's nice. Yeah, so definitely we have South Africa is
lovely, man.
Is definitely our second home.
Some of the films I'd love to recommend for you to watch.
Okay,
and I'd love to try and get these off the shelves and rent them to you. Perhaps you've seen some of them. One of which we're talking about is Warfare, which has just come out. It's an A24 film, and it is set in Iraq. It's in one of these street battles.
I've seen a trailer.
The whole film takes place over one afternoon in one of these street battles. A scrappy, fucking ridiculous moment.
Yeah.
And you'll appreciate it. So it's Alex Garland.
Yeah,
He wrote The Beach, which people forget about. He's done incredible stuff. Civil War, which is another film I want to recommend if you haven't seen it.
I've seen it. Yeah.
Okay, so I assumed you'd seen Civil War.
Yeah.
Because Civil War, sorry, just to dial back, came out last year, and it was this whole big thing of like, imagine America having a civil war now.
Yeah.
Which doesn't feel too far away with the likes of Trump, you know, being so divisive and dividing the country.
And it's told from the perspective of war photographers.
Exactly. And that's where it kind of got a little bit lost, is that I think people saw it. It got a bit presented wrongly, in my opinion. It got presented like it was this kind of fantastical, big, epic kind of movie, the kind of movie that like a Dwayne Johnson would be in.
Yeah.
You know, how crazy would it be when tanks were rolling through this, and they created all these fantastical, bigger scenarios. But what the movie actually was a very small story. It was about three people traveling from one place to another, getting to the capital.
Three photographers, journalists,
specifically war photographers, to get to the capital because the president's going to fall.
Yeah,
yeah. And that was
I enjoyed it.
It was a fucking incredible movie.
And there was one. There's one particular scene that I'm not going to give everything away. But there's what's that actor called again? There was he's the husband in real life, the husband of the main character. What's in it? She used to be in Spider-Man movies.
Yeah, Kirsten Dunst. Forget who her husband was.
Yeah, he's that. Radicalized guy who then shoots them and they're digging a mass grave.
Oh, okay. They married in real life.
But not
married in the movie.
This is
Jesse Plemons.
Yeah, incredible actor.
And there's that great moment where the guy says, but we're Americans,
and he's so scary,
and he just goes, which kind?
Yeah,
which Americans? So scary. Scary.
That scene will always stick with me.
Yes, it's such a contained moment. And then the final sort of attack on the sort of the siege of the White House to get to the president.
Yeah.
Fuck, it's a good movie. Okay, so this is Civil War. But then Alex Garland co-wrote this film Warfare, which I think I'll put on my list. I think you need to see it. Perhaps it could be triggering for you or same old. But for me, I think it was one of the closest documents I might ever get to understanding what that scene is like for you, which you know. Because this is a film that's trying to be as accurate to real-life Navy SEAL sniper operation as one could ever get.
Okay.
Because it's based on real memories and the guys that were involved in this particular moment.
It was I remember that it was based on the book, right? It was a guy who was a veteran who
Ray Mendoza co-wrote it.
I think I read the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what I'd actually like to rent to you is a film that snuck out through Apple TV Plus. So we don't always get those movies unless you have that subscription. And it's called The Greatest Beer Run Ever. Do you know
never
about this movie?
No, never heard of it. It sounds amazing, though.
It's got Zac Efron in it.
Okay.
Russell Crowe.
Okay.
And it's set in the Vietnam era, and it's based on a true story, which was a guy who said, "I'm all my friends are over there in Vietnam. They seem to be struggling. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get there, and I'm going to give them a beer."
Okay.
Sort of like this dumb idea. He came up with it with his friends in a bar.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know what? I'm going to get to fucking Vietnam. And he takes a suitcase full of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
And he
gets into Vietnam, finds his friends, and literally hands them this beer.
Amazing.
Where they're like, what the fuck are you doing here? Like, why are you here?
Yeah.
And why it's interesting is just... For you, I think it'll be a good film because it's just fun. It's quite light. And it really gets into the weeds of Vietnam, which was a very complicated war in history.
Yeah.
But why it's interesting for people, and especially you, is that quite a lot of the movie is around how easy it is to get into a war zone, but how fucking difficult it is to get out.
Dude.
And so he takes a military ship. He's like, I can't believe I'm here. Shit, that was easy.
Yeah.
And then the guys are like, we can't get you out.
No, we're not going to get you back.
And quite a lot of it, and Russell Crowe plays a war photographer, a little more seasoned, a little more veteran. And Zac Efron's just this sort of young American, naive dude.
Sounds great.
And it's based on a true story. The Greatest Beer Run Ever.
So two things I want to say about that. It's like, you're right, what you said about... a lot of people ask me, like, what is it like to work there? And what is it... You know, you have a... Look... The reality is, if you maybe have 5 minutes of action in a day, right, where they're shooting. The rest of the day, you're sitting in cars, you're trying to get from A to B.
Yeah,
that's the hardest thing you have to freaking do that day.
Yeah,
so that's one thing. And then the second thing is, dude, I've met so many people of this kind of like the story you told about the guy wanting to get a beer into Vietnam.
Yeah,
I've met so many weird people.
Yeah.
In war zones, that there was one guy who tried to get on the
border. But they are there.
They shouldn't be there. There was one guy who came on his bicycle in the border of Syria, and there were bombings and everything. You know, they were bombing ISIS, and there was all the media was standing there and just filming it from a distance because we didn't have access, we couldn't get in, etc. And this dude shows up like an adventurous cyclist, and he's like, he looked at me, he's like, they're not letting me into Syria. What the fuck?
Yeah.
I was like, dude, what the fuck?
Why the fuck do you want to be there?
Yeah. What are you doing here? Go home. Like, what are you? There's so many.
And he was just like, no, I want to check it out.
Yeah, I just want to check it out. I'm crossing all the way through from, you know, I don't know what he was doing, from Europe all the way to Africa. This is my plan. I want to go there.
Go around Syria.
Yeah, go around. Yeah, exactly. Like,
cycle
take
around.
Take a plane.
Just don't go straight.
Yeah, so many of these guys, so many typical stories, man.
Wild.
It attracts the weirdest people.
Yeah.
Really does.
Listen, man, but you got to be safe. Are you going to be safe in Afghanistan?
Yeah,
I think
totally.
You should be fine. Hey?
Yeah, Afghanistan's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If you stick to the rules.
Yeah.
Or grow a beard. That's it.
You're fine.
Yeah. Listen, man, this has been a real treat. I really appreciate you.
Thanks so
much. And I really appreciate our friendship. It's amazing you know, at a certain point in your life, you never quite know who you'll be able to see again.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I've been lucky enough to travel, as I said. And you know, when we did our first tour to Japan and we formed this incredible friendship with this other band, when we had to say goodbye for the first time, there was this mixed feeling of like, well, what do we do?
Yeah.
And I was just like, my friend, I said to the one guy, I was like, you and me, we're going to drink whiskey together when we're 70.
We're
going to be friends forever. You won't see each other all the time.
That's it.
But we'll be friends forever. And then it like clicked in his head through the broken English. He was like, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
It's just like, until then.
Oh, so many friendships like that all over the world. And I can knock on somebody's door in Barcelona and I know I have a place to sleep.
Just the other day, I got reconnected with this couple that myself and my ex, when we were traveling India, one night on one of our train trips, our overnight train trips, we just met this British couple. that just happened to be in the same compartment. Yeah. We spent the whole night playing cards.
Yeah, yeah.
And we kept in touch.
Nice. Yeah, that's great.
When I performed in London, they came and watched.
Nice.
And then now recently, now they've come and seen me and my wife, and they got kids, you know.
It's fantastic. Like, that's great, man.
It's like,
I love that.
But we're like, we'll see you in another 5 years, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, thank you for being one of those people in my life. I think you have done some really interesting stuff in your life and will continue to do that.
Thank you so much.
And I'd love
it's great to be here, man.
I'd love to hear more stories as we go.
Always.
Thanks so much, man. I'll see you soon.
Cool.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. What a lekker chat.
Yeah.
Lekker dude.
Mm.
And of course, he lives up to his reputation as being a very tall man.
All right.
The Dutch are very tall. No, but a great dude, and what a treat to have had a chance to get to know him and have him in my life. I really appreciate these kinds of people that you don't necessarily get to see every day, but you'll catch up with every little bit every now and again, and you stay in touch.
Cool.
So yeah, a real treat.
Amazing.
We have lots of other guest episodes.
Yeah.
We don't do them as much as we once did.
Yeah.
We are focusing more behind the counter, getting to chat more behind the counter. But over at thevideostore.co.za are links to all our other guest episodes.
Yes.
And we will see you again next week.
Yeah.
Hey, come on back.
Come back, please.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.